So we built like this has always been here. And it unfortunately, the barrier island of Miami Beach and all the barrier islands of the world are going to be inundated, compromised, eroded, storm surged across more aggressively in the pretty near future. So.
And could you talk about the government policy related to this in places like Miami or New Orleans, that it's actually to build much more, spend billions on constructing man-made barriers instead of relocating populations and having the whole country have to pay for folks who want to live by the ocean?
And we just have 30 seconds.
That's a very good question. And it's the same question on floodplains, where we're now having more aggressive floods. But this is a very fair question. And I don't think there's an easy answer for it. The problem with Miami, we live on very porous limestone. So you can't put a dike or a levee around us and keep the water out. It'll come right up through the rock.
Dr. Harold Wanless, we're going to be back with you soon. Critical analysis, professor of geography and urban sustainability at the University of Miami, leading a project called The Invading Sea. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Did you miss the Soul and Hip Hop Marathon on Juneteenth weekend? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/soul2021 to listen to the archive show. You can also snag a limited edition Soul and Hip Hop t-shirt before July 7th to show your support for the music and programming you love. Again, you can catch the Soul and Hip Hop Marathon and snag a limited edition t-shirt at kboo.fm/soul2021.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown has lifted COVID-19 restrictions in all 36 counties. Bill Cosby will be released from prison, and in international news, the heat wave continues its unrelenting quest through the Northwest and into Canada. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 30th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. As of 12:01 a.m. Wednesday morning, Oregon's COVID-19 restrictions have been lifted in all 36 counties. The state will no longer require that people wear masks indoors or outdoors, but businesses can still set their own rules, and some may require face coverings. All folks will still be required to follow federal mask mandates, which apply to public transportation, the airport, prison, and healthcare settings like hospitals and nursing homes. All occupancy restrictions have been lifted on indoor and outdoor gatherings, and that includes restaurants, bars, strip clubs, gyms, the mall, and other venues. However, just like with masks, businesses can set their own occupancy rules. Social distancing requirements also no longer apply. Despite the lifting of most COVID-19 restrictions, health officials recommend that all unvaccinated people, about 30% of adult Oregonians, still continue to wear masks in indoor public spaces and get vaccinated if possible. Though the mask requirement has been lifted, residents of Los Angeles are being urged to continue wearing masks indoors. On Monday, Los Angeles County health officials recommended that, quote, everyone, regardless of vaccination status, wear masks indoors in public places as a precautionary measure. With a new variant of COVID-19 rapidly spreading across the globe, the World Health Organization is also urging folks to continue wearing masks. The Delta variant, a highly infectious form of the virus first detected in India, has been identified in at least 85 countries. It's also been found in the United States and accounts for 1 in 4 coronavirus infections. Dr. Barbara Ferrer is LA County's public health director. She says the recommendation is also needed due to the recent uptick in infections and persistently high numbers of unvaccinated residents, including children under the age of 12. Roughly half of LA County residents are vaccinated, with 60% having received at least one dose. Though the number of positive cases still falls below 1%, Dr. Ferrer says the rate has been inching up, including numerous reinfections in folks who had the virus and didn't get vaccinated. Countries in the Asia-Pacific region are reimposing restrictions and stay-at-home orders. Four cities in Australia have reimposed lockdowns. Israel, which has one of the highest vaccination rates in the world and is working aggressively to immunize younger people, has also reinstated masking requirements in public indoor spaces. Dr. Bruce Aylward of the WHO said last week, quote, "What we're saying is once you've been fully vaccinated, continue to play it safe because you could end up as part of a transmission chain. You may not actually be fully protected." Governor Kate Brown has declared a state of emergency in Oregon due to the ongoing threat of wildfires. At a press conference on Tuesday, Brown said, quote, "Oregon is still recovering from the devastation of last year's wildfires, which resulted in 9 Oregonians losing their lives and thousands more losing their homes. With wildfires already sparking this year, it is imperative that we act now to prevent further loss," end quote. The declaration authorizes the Oregon Department of Forestry and the Oregon State Fire Marshal to use more resources when fighting fires. The U.S. Forest Service has prohibited campfires on national forest grounds in the region, including Mount Hood National Forest, Gifford Pinchot National Forest, and Forest Service lands in the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. Those restrictions begin on July 1st. Additionally, counties and towns across the Portland metro area have banned fireworks due to the dry conditions and record-shattering high temperatures. Public lands protecting sensitive coastal habitats help generate income for local communities, and they're open to the general public. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
A system of little-known public lands protecting sensitive coastal habitats generate big economic impacts for local communities. That's the finding of a new study that looks at 4 sites of the National Estuarine Research Reserve System. The reserves are open to the public and provide a platform for research. The South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve near Coos Bay, which was the first reserve in the system, generates more than $6 million in revenue a year. Pete Wiley, an economist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, explains how.
Each research reserve spends money on its operations and maintenance. Each reserve has visitors that come for the educational programming or recreational opportunities, and those visitors spend money in the local community.
The South Slough supports 65 jobs and brings in close to 10,000 visitors each year. The study was commissioned by NOAA and the Pew Charitable Trust. The Oregon Reserve and 3 Florida reserves in this study are estimated to generate more than $165 million in annual revenue for their communities, including more than $55 million in wages for more than 1,700 jobs. Bree Yednock, manager of the South Slough Reserve, says the economics are valuable, but notes the benefits of the region go beyond what's shown in the study.
South Slough Reserve, we know from our water quality monitoring program, results in clean water, and that in turn supports a thriving oyster aquaculture industry. We know that the projects that we do in the reserve to restore habitat creates important habitat for commercially and recreationally important species. For us, that's salmon, and that's Dungeness crabs.
Yednock adds scientists at the reserve also study the effects of climate change and conduct sustainability research. The national system protects 29 ecologically sensitive areas in 23 states and Puerto Rico. At least 3 other states could join the system with their own reserves soon. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned Bill Cosby's sexual assault conviction today after finding an agreement with a previous prosecutor prevented him from being charged in the case. Cosby was sentenced in 2018 to 10 years in prison for drugging and sexually assaulting Andrea Kostand at his home 14 years ago and had already served more than 2 years of his sentence. He was released from prison earlier today. In May, Cosby was denied parole after refusing to participate in sex offender programs in the state prison near Philadelphia. He has long said he would refuse to acknowledge wrongdoing, even if it meant serving the full 10-year sentence. According to court documents, the prosecutor in the case never told the plaintiff of his decision to permanently forgo prosecuting Cosby in criminal court. Attorney Georgia Allred represented many of the women who have accused Cosby of misconduct. She says today's decision to release him is devastating, and that, quote, "My heart especially goes out to those who bravely testified in both of his criminal cases. This was an important fight for justice, and even though the court overturned the conviction on technical grounds, it did not vindicate Bill Cosby's conduct and should not be interpreted as a statement or a finding that he did not engage in the acts of which he has been accused." Around 60 women have accused Cosby of sexual abuse in events that span between 1965 and 2008. Most of those assaults occurred beyond the statute of limitations, as most of the victims did not come forward until Constant made her own charges public. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected a request to lift the federal ban on evictions, choosing instead to uphold the CDC's eviction moratorium. With more on that story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Part of the reason I moved here was not only to be near my daughter, but also to come in the summer to have relief from Arizona heat. And I seem to have brought it with me.
Seattle resident Stanley James talks about the unprecedented heat wave fueled by the climate crisis, with all-time high temperatures shattered in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia for the second day in a row. Seattle reached 108 degrees Fahrenheit on Monday, and Portland hit 116. The Supreme Court has left intact a nationwide pause on evictions put into place amid the pandemic. The 5-4 vote rejected an emergency request from a group of landlords that had asked the court to effectively end the CDC's eviction moratorium, which is set to run through July 31st. The e-cigarette maker Juul Labs has agreed to pay $40 million to settle a lawsuit brought by North Carolina, charging its marketing practices led to widespread nicotine addiction among teenagers. North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein.
North Carolina is now the first state in the nation to hold Juul accountable for its instrumental role in creating a youth vaping epidemic.
The settlement comes as 13 other states and the District of Columbia are pressing similar lawsuits, and as the FDA is considering whether to allow Juul products to remain on the market. In Florida, hope is fading. Search and rescue crews will find more survivors of the Surfside condominium disaster, 5 days after the building suddenly collapsed. The confirmed death toll has risen to 11, with 150 people still unaccounted for. At least 10 states this year have enacted so-called Second Amendment sanctuary laws. The bills are meant to preempt tighter gun control measures that could come from the Biden administration. A new Missouri law imposes a $50,000 fine on any state or local official who enforces a federal gun law that's not also on the books in Missouri. Kentucky Republican Representative Josh Bray says his state is considering similar legislation.
The 10th Amendment gives the state the right to enforce everything that isn't expressly laid out in the Constitution. And so we feel like it's the state's responsibility to enforce the Second Amendment.
The U.S. ranks last in media trust, according to a Reuters survey of news consumers in 46 countries. The Poynter Institute's Rick Edmonds says the extreme degree of political polarization is partly to blame.
Which is no news that that exists, but that it translates into that dramatically low rating compared to all kinds of different countries, Poland, the Philippines.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan. Thanks for listening.
Washington has passed a measure guaranteeing tenants have the right to legal counsel in eviction cases. It's the first state in the nation to pass such a bill, and it could help in the fight for tenant rights. Eric Tegedoff has more.
With the threats of evictions rising as the pandemic eases, Washington State took a major step this year to protect tenants. In the 2021 session, state lawmakers passed a measure guaranteeing tenants have a right to legal counsel in eviction cases. It was the first state in the nation to pass such a bill. John Pollock with the National Coalition for a Civil Right to Counsel calls it transformative.
The movement has been very successful in the last 5 years at the municipal level, but Washington State was the first one to show that it could be done at the state level as well.
Pollack says Connecticut and Maryland joined Washington shortly after this bill passed, and notes that at least 11 states have introduced similar legislation, signaling how mainstream this issue has become. Governor Jay Inslee says the state will extend the eviction moratorium beyond Wednesday. Pollack says only about 3% of tenants have legal representation in eviction cases. He also notes that for the person who might be evicted, there is much more at stake than their homes.
Child care, child custody, your physical liberty, your health, your employment, and so on. Counsel makes a huge difference from the studies that we've seen. It literally changes what happens in housing court, and the vast majority of tenants avoid eviction or the serious consequences.
Pollack says it can be hard for people to rent once they have an eviction on their record. He also notes that this is a significant race equity issue, with Black women facing eviction rates at least twice as high as white people.
In a country where we're wrestling with race equity and looking at what it looks like or what it should look like, we cannot ignore the plight and the situation in our housing courts, which are a reflection of the lack of that kind of equity.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Noise Filter, Debunking COVID-19. At 5:45, we'll follow that with News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's special programming from Public Affairs. Then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 63 degrees. Tomorrow we can expect partly cloudy skies and a high of 81. Today in history, on this day in 1974, Alberta Williams King died. She was Martin Luther King Jr.'s mother and was herself assassinated 6 years after his death. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "Never, never be afraid to do what's right, especially if the well-being of a person or animal is at stake. Society's punishments are small compared to the wounds we inflict on our soul when we look the other way." Catholic Bishops of Canada announced Tuesday an Indigenous delegation will meet with Pope Francis later this year, saying he is committed to hearing directly from Indigenous people. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops announced Tuesday an Indigenous delegation will meet with Pope Francis in December. The trip to the Vatican is scheduled to take place December 17th through 20th. The Catholic Bishops of Canada, in a statement, said Pope Francis is committed to hearing directly from Indigenous people and addressing the impacts of the role of the Church in the residential school system. The delegation will include First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people who are elders, knowledge keepers, residential school survivors, and young people. They're expected to meet with the Pope on December 20th. The announcement follows the grim discovery in May and June of hundreds of remains at former Indian residential schools in British Columbia and Saskatchewan. Native leaders have long called on the Pope to issue a formal apology. The recent discoveries are renewing those calls. Chief Roseanne Casimir asked again after the discovery of 215 remains at the Kamloops Indian Residential School in BC.
In the end, what we do want an apology, a public apology, not just for us, but for the world who also shared in those suffrages. There has never been an apology from the Roman Catholic.
The residential school was run by the Catholic Church for nearly 80 years until the Canadian government took over. Canadian politicians are also calling for an apology. Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller expressed the need following the Kamloops discovery.
I think it is shameful that they haven't done it to date. Certainly, my Catholic friends that I speak to believe it should be done. There is a responsibility that lies squarely on the shoulders of the Council of Bishops of Canada.
In 2015, Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission requested an official apology from the Pope for the atrocities that took place in the residential school system. 2 years later, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau personally requested it during a visit to the Vatican. Native leaders are now calling on the Pope to issue a formal apology in Canada. The Little Shell Tribal Council has announced a new food sovereignty program for tribal members all over the state of Montana. The program will raise cattle and grow vegetables to provide healthier food for the community. Yellowstone Public Radio's Taylor Stagner has more.
The Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa bought around 750 acres of co-op farmland in the historic 57 area of Great Falls. The project is funded by the CARES Act in order to help increase access to nutritious foods during the COVID-19 pandemic. Gerald Gray is the chairman of the council. He says that the tribe partners with other organizations to deliver food boxes to tribal members who need it most.
So then we thought, well, we'll start our own food sovereignty program, which is just to start for now as some cows that we'll be able to graze and finish and then have them processed, and then the meat will go to, you know, elders and veterans and those in most need.
Chairman Gray says that historically Indigenous communities have had less access to fresh vegetables or high-protein foods because of historic discrimination, leaving many communities far away from sustainable food systems.
The government's always run a commodity program, and we just feel that this is a better source of some protein for our members that the tribe can do for them.
The Little Shell Food Sovereignty Program is looking into building greenhouses to start producing vegetables and eventually a wild game processing plant to distribute locally hunted venison. The program looks to be in full swing by next summer. For National Native News, I'm Taylor Stagner.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
While the heat bubble has left Oregon, it has intensified and turned deadly in British Columbia, causing hundreds of deaths with temperatures reaching as high as 121 degrees. Police in the Vancouver area responded to over 230 sudden death calls, and province-wide fatalities are still being counted. Yesterday's high of 121 in Lytton, British Columbia, was the third consecutive day of record high temperatures for Canada. The previous national record had been set in 1937. By contrast, the highest record temperature in Las Vegas is 117. Referring to the Pacific Northwest, climate activist Greta Thunberg said today, quote, "We're in a climate emergency that has never once been treated as an emergency." President Joe Biden also blamed the climate crisis for the record-shattering heat wave in the Northwest, and heat waves are becoming both more common and more intense around the planet. Already, extreme heat is one of the deadliest types of weather-related events in the United States, killing on average over 700 people each year. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael feels the heat is far from over.
When the temperature went from 116 to 92, we were so relieved we forgot 92 is still hot. Similarly, when Biden replaced Trump, we thought this is so great, but is it? We're reminded of the limits of the president's power. We're reminded of who Joe Biden is. He bombed Iranians in Iraq and Syria last week. And we see how unchecked and balanced our so-called democracy has become. I watched Selma the other night and see how those successes at voters' rights are being sent back in time across the South and in a paralyzed D.C. Joe Manchin couldn't get a watered-down voters' rights bill passed. McConnell won't pass both infrastructure bills, while progressives insist a compromise alone is nowhere near what's needed. In the heat bubble, heat from the South got trapped by high pressure from the North. We need pressure from all directions, all states, to pop the status quo bubble that keeps the rich chill and prospering, while the rest of us swelter and gasp in the vacuums of agency, hope, and opportunity. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Several Twin Cities co-ops hosted Art and Abolition, a community celebration of protest art created over the past year. Participating artist Maya Lee Hartman says her work seeks to honor lives lost and celebrate Black people. With more on the story, it's Choma Uwagu with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Last week, several Twin Cities co-ops hosted Art and Abolition, a community celebration of protest art created over the past year. Seward Co-op's Addie DeMary says the event is a follow-up to last summer when the store invited BIPOC artists to create murals on its boarded-up windows.
I feel like art is a way to express pain, but also happiness, and also like a revolution. And I feel like a lot of the art that was put up at our stores told the story of what happened, you know, the pain, and also how community members had come together.
DeMary says even grocery stores have a role to play in the social justice movement. One of the participating artists, Maya Lee Hartman, created a portrait of Micaiah Bryant for the one-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. The 16-year-old girl was shot by police in Columbus, Ohio this past April. Micaiah's face is shown inside a fortune teller's crystal ball. She's surrounded by flowers and the words, "We deserve a future where all our babies can grow old."
How often do our babies not even get to experience being babies because of that fear that Black people have to hold? That is the reality that, like, at any point, that could be your fate. It's important to honor all of the lives that have been lost, and there's so many, and for me, it was important to honor Micaiah Bryant just alongside George Floyd.
Hartman says she likes to create artwork that people feel compelled to touch and physically interact with. She says she's always looking for a balance between honoring lives and celebrating Black people. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Chomo Wagu.
Nonprofits in the green energy sector say careful planning is needed to build a clean energy economy that supports workers. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Action to reduce global warming could create a lot of new jobs, from wind and solar farm construction to green building and electric vehicle manufacturing. Jason Walsh is executive director of the Blue Green Alliance, a nonprofit that works on environmental and labor issues.
The challenge is going to be making sure that as we make this transition, those jobs are created in all parts of the country, including in parts of the country that are losing fossil fuel jobs.
He says governments can help. For example, a proposed federal tax credit would reward companies for locating facilities in areas that have lost coal jobs.
We're also going to need to address job quality. Clean energy jobs, on average, pay less than fossil energy jobs on average.
He says that's partly a result of strong unions in the fossil fuel industry. So his group advocates for increasing the role of unions in clean energy. And it calls for training programs to help local residents qualify for new jobs. Walsh says he's hopeful that, with planning and coordination, the country can build a clean energy economy that supports workers with good-paying jobs. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
An important part of coastal ecosystems has been disappearing since the 1950s. It's eelgrass. Since eelgrass has numerous benefits, like improving water quality, researchers are putting together dozens of studies to figure out the best way to bring it back. Suzanne Potter has the story.
An important part of California's coastal ecosystem, the eelgrass, is disappearing, with 90% gone since the 1950s. Now, a report commissioned by the Pew Charitable Trust finds that from 50 to 65% of the eelgrass restoration efforts are successful. The study says the choice of where to replant is the most important factor. Study co-author Melissa Ward, a postdoctoral researcher at San Diego State University, says eelgrass has many benefits.
It can improve water quality, it stabilizes the sediments, it also acts as a nursery habitat for a lot of baby animals like Dungeness crab, California spiny lobster, halibut, and Pacific herring.
The research pulls together dozens of studies to establish best practices for eelgrass restoration. Eelgrass is abundant in Humboldt Bay up north and is being restored in Mission Bay in San Diego, and a community program to restore it in Newport Bay has been very successful. But Morro Bay, for example, lost 97% of its eelgrass from 2007 to 2017 due to variations in water circulation and sediment from natural causes and from man-made changes to the harbor. Lexi Bell is with the Morro Bay National Estuary Program and the Pacific Marine Estuarine Fish Habitat Partnership, which released the study. She notes the role that eelgrass restoration can play in the fight against climate change.
Eelgrass can help reduce erosion, and that can be a factor with coastal flooding. And it absorbs carbon, so the more eelgrass you have, the more carbon you can absorb.
Ward says she'd like to see California develop and fund a standard monitoring program for eelgrass.
We know it's super important, but we have no funding to even monitor on a statewide level where seagrass is and how quickly it's being lost.
She says people can help by making sure not to drop anchor in an eelgrass bed while boating and by supporting efforts to reduce polluted runoff into the sea. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 30th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, the producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. A special thank you to Nat Moon. This was their final broadcast as one of our producers. They have been instrumental in helping us hold down the fort for the past year of pandemic production. So thank you so much, Nat, for all of your hard work. We'd also like to thank Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Suzanne Potter, Nadia Ramagan, Eric Tegedoff, and Chuma Uwagu. The director of Evening News is the ever-wonderful Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 9, it's Fight the Empire, bridging the gap between history and current events. At 9:30, it's Radio Zine, bringing you a variety of exciting public affairs programming. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news journalism focusing on human rights and economic justice. Then at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, and tomorrow features an interview with Bobby Bermea sharing the story of a writing workshop for Black women. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for COVID Noise Filter.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder, that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Potential for fall resurgence of COVID if vaccination rates do not increase. So the approach of summer in America has been something of a reprieve from the worst of the pandemic. The death rate has remained low, and vaccinations have provided some relief for many Americans. However, according to Vox, we should be wary of a fall resurgence of the virus. Vox cites three reasons for this risk: vaccination rates, variants, and seasonability. First, the vaccination rates in the nation has started to slow down. Many Americans still aren't vaccinated, and the daily rate for new inoculations has halved since April. Now, while vaccines seem to do a good job of fighting variants so far, they still overcome natural immunity in some cases. This means that unvaccinated Americans with natural immunity may be more susceptible to variants, and the immunity may not last as long as that which is provided by the vaccine. While vaccinated immunity may also wane over time, research so far has found it to be more effective than natural immunity. Researchers also believe that COVID sees a certain amount of seasonability. This means that it may spread more easily in colder weather. However, according to Vox, many Americans began to socialize outside more safely in the warmer season, and as death rates continue to drop, they won't see a need to get vaccinated. This could leave them vulnerable to a winter resurgence, especially as natural immunity fades. This resurgence is unlikely to be a major national outbreak. It is more likely to be local and state-level spikes in part of the country with low rates of vaccinations. This resurgence shouldn't serve as a reason to panic, but as a call to get vaccinated and to avoid this event altogether. Missouri and other states struggle to collect adequate racial data for vaccines. Now, COVID-19 has disproportionately affected the Black and Hispanic communities across the board in both cases and rates of vaccinations. Now, according to NPR, the U.S. has made equity in access to the vaccine a priority because of this. However, data collection from vaccine sites has no standard across states or even counties. This means that the individual health departments have been left on their own to develop systems to collect racial and ethnic data. And the inconsistencies in collection have made it harder to tell if the vaccination efforts are actually equitable. In Missouri, the system seems to have some glaring errors. For example, there is a complicated vaccination rate of more than 60% among multiracial residents. The director of the Kansas City Health Department thinks a number this high is indicative of issues with collection, and state officials have said the same since February. Now, there are a few possible reasons for the errors in Missouri. One is that people may have reported different racial data before each dose of the vaccine. In other cases, the data was missing altogether, and the states use multiple miscellaneous categories like other or unknown. The state has included national racial data in their own state data. While Missouri's population is around 2% Asian, the vaccine data says that almost 6% of the population is Asian. Now, while Missouri and state officials haven't announced any plans to repair the discrepancies, the state is working to improve its vaccination rate in minority communities. They recently authorized federal funds to increase the vaccinations in Black communities with low rates in hopes of addressing both access and vaccine hesitancy. Child labor increases. The economic impact of the pandemic, school closures, and the lack of government assistance in many countries has pushed many children into exploitative and dangerous child labor. Children are working in brick kilns, carpet factories, gold mines, and stone quarries, among other places. They feel that they have to work because their family needs support and that they are not getting from their individual governments. There was nothing they could do if their parents died or lost their jobs. The family needs to eat, states a 13-year-old Ugandan girl, and the decrease in inspections probably led to unethical employers to capitalize on this exploited behavior. An interview of 81 children between the ages of 18 and 17 from Ghana, Nepal, and Uganda allowed many to truly understand what they were going through, the first being long hours. More than a third of children worked more than 10 hours a day, and for some, 7 days a week. There was also little compensation despite having to work in hard, hazardous conditions. And lastly, some children described having to handle toxic mercury in order to extract gold from ore, and others mentioned using machete-like tools to clear fields. So there are many ways to help children, fortunately, but it does take a group effort. Governments need to prioritize cash allowances in response to the pandemic to families in order to prevent children from trying to make a living wage. And further, there needs to be a national back-to-school campaign to ensure children have the opportunity to go back to school. Technical medical language may exacerbate COVID inequities. Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, understanding rapidly changing information and advisories about the virus has been essential. Now, according to NPR, the medical jargon and technical language used in many resources regarding COVID have made them inaccessible to non-native English speakers, older individuals, and people with limited literacy. Now, this is not a new issue. According to a researcher at the Harvard Data Science Initiative, approximately 14% of Americans have a below basic health literacy. This means they lack the ability to understand health information that they need in order to make decisions regarding their health and medical care. Now, this can manifest as misidentifying the names of drugs, being able to understand instructions, for taking prescriptions, or even misusing over-the-counter medications. So when the Journal of the American Medical Association reviewed government website information about COVID, both at the state and federal levels, they found that the language was higher than the eighth grade level, making it inaccessible to many Americans. This means that the language tended to be wordy, included words that were too long, and used medical jargon that was difficult to understand. So, according to the CDC, it's important to ensure that medical language is culturally competent, which means that some medical advisors should be accessible across racial, ethnic, and religious lines. For example, public health advisories should be easily translatable so that it can't be misinterpreted into other languages, and visual signifiers of poor health should be described in ways that aren't contingent upon skin color or other visual signifiers. One woman, a student at Harvard Medical School, started the COVID-19 Health Literacy Project to tackle this. The group is comprised of multilingual students in the health field who produce fact sheets about COVID-19 in more than 40 languages. The fact sheets are then reviewed by the faculty members before they're shared. I think this is a great idea. I think this is awesome. I think we need more innovation like this. And again, many, many, many kudos to those that are making health literacy more accessible all around. Early studies find the pandemic hit caregivers hard. So an April study in The Gerontologist compared around 600 family caregivers to 3,000 non-caregivers and found that the caregivers reported higher rates of anxiety, depression, and sleep deprivation. Caregivers also said they were more socially isolated and had more concerns about finances across socioeconomic statuses. The women, young people, and low-income caregivers reported the worst symptoms overall. So pandemic well-being also seemed to be affected by the type of care. Caregivers treating people with cognitive disabilities and behavioral and emotional problems seemed to report a more negative experience as well. Another study conducted by Harvard sociologists differentiated between long and short-term caregivers. According to the study, all caregivers reported more anxiety and fatigue than the population at large, but long-term caregivers tended to report physical symptoms like headaches. Pandemic shutdowns also created difficulties for caregivers in accessing support and care for these issues. And as COVID patients took priorities in hospitals, support groups ended up moving online. Now, according to the New York Times, further studies are needed to determine if any of these issues waned as the pandemic went on. But there's also a chance that the duration could have exacerbated these issues. Two Biden administration proposals geared to go through the Senate could help provide relief for some caregivers. The American Jobs Plan would provide money to increase access to home care through Medicaid and increase the wages for home care workers. According to the Times, however, this may not be helpful to seniors who aren't Medicaid eligible. The American Families Plan hopes to establish federal paid family and medical leave, eventually providing 12 weeks of paid leave. Dogs could sniff out COVID. Listen, how would you react if you go to get tested for coronavirus and find that your test doesn't actually involve a swab, but a cute and furry dog? Researchers say that this could be a possibility, as dogs have the ability to tell if a person is infected with coronavirus, even if they are asymptomatic, because of their incredible sense of smell. Now, according to the Wall Street Journal, dogs can do this because they have more than 300 million scent receptors and can detect compounds that the human body releases in secretions, like sweat and saliva, especially as it reacts to coronavirus. Now, comparatively, humans have a modest 5 million scent receptors. Now, What these dogs are being trained to do is actually not new. They have long been trained to detect odors associated with drugs or explosives and have also been used to identify diseases such as cancer, malaria, and diabetes. However, according to one of the first researchers to evaluate the potential for dogs to sniff out COVID, this is the first time that dogs are able to detect a viral disease in humans. Now, the investigation to determine if it would be a viable option to use dogs as COVID testers is well underway. And in fact, in a report by the World Health Organization, one dog can screen 250 to 300 people per day at a fraction of the cost of nasal swabs. But listen, don't get too excited just yet, because experts say more research is needed to answer some of the unresolved questions, like whether dogs can be confused by other viruses or by vaccines. While you won't see any COVID testing dogs at your next doctor's appointment anytime soon, that time may be coming sooner than later. And let's hope for that, because it would be great to see dogs being used to test for coronavirus. How awesome is that? Definitely, definitely a silver lining in the COVID-19 story. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time, where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram, Noise Filter NOLA on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to noisefiltershow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Jenny Yokoyama, and I'm also one of KBOO's interim station co-managers.